Good afternoon, everyone. This is Angela Salerno. I'm hosting a hearing on regulations that the Department of Health and Social Services, Division of Senior and Disability Services, proposes to adopt as changes to Title VII, Chapter 130 and 160, Medicaid Home and Community-Based Waiver Services. We invite your comments at this time. We will be here until 4:30. And I believe we have one person online who is ready to testify. Connor O'Day, please go ahead and give your testimony.
Yeah, thank you. I guess more just kind of questions and clarifications on the language in a bit more detail on
Connor,
these propositions.
This is a regulation hearing. This is the time that we hear from you. I am not authorized to answer questions or clarify at this time. I apologize.
Okay. Well, given the vagueness of what was provided to us, it's going to be kind of difficult to do, but I will go and move forward with what you just said.
You have some comments you want to make?
Yes. In particular, there's the comment or the proposed change to adult day services and which services will be paid for. I'm sorry, I'm trying to find which number. Number 11, proposed to amend to further define what adult day services the department will pay for. Within the state of Alaska, I'm not exactly sure what that means as far as define what adult day services the department will pay for, in the sense of, I didn't realize there was different kinds of adult day services within Alaska. And what exactly it means to break up and specify what services will and won't be paid for.
Connor?
Either, yes.
I can tell you that that's a convention that simply means when you bill for adult day services, we will pay for it. There aren't several kinds of adult day services. It's simply a convention we use to make clear what we will pay for.
Okay. Okay. And with number 8, provider termination of services to a recipient, just for comment, hoping that this means that people receiving services will be receiving more time that a provider needs to notify them of whether they're going to be terminating their services or not. And as far as when you guys will be addressing that. Medication administration, your number 6. I think my comment there would be the, especially pertaining to adult day, to really make sure that the curriculum addresses assistance with administration as opposed to administering, to make that clear for the adult day providers around Alaska, that there isn't making sure that there's clear separation between the medical and the social model. And then looking at the 16, those are the respite care services. Again, I'm hoping that what this means is that the respite services, as you were commenting earlier on adult day, it'll just be paid for as far as furthering to define what services the department will pay for and define the terms used in this section. given the great amount of need for respite services, especially in the Juneau community, I think it would be detrimental to kind of put any more restraint on what is respite, especially when it comes to focusing on the primary caregiver receiving respite services. And, yeah, that is it.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Mary Nickerson, would you like to give your testimony, please?
Not at this time. Thank you.
Okay. How about Sherry Mettler?
I'm here. I was kind of hoping to hear from Teresa Brisky that might be in the Anchorage office first, but I will just go through a few concerns that we have. Number one, we were under the impression that this was a housekeeping set of regs, and we just see a lot of information that to us is really effective into assisted living and adult daycare and some other issues, especially between the provider conditions of participation as well as the regulations here. And I'm just going to I'm going to use the pages in the regulations if I can, just because it's a little easier than trying to spew off the 7AAC 130, blah, blah, blah. So, for instance, on page 3, and I'd just like to put this out here for public testimony. We got these regs on the 28th of May. We have 9 business days in which to look intelligent on this public testimony, and I feel anything but adequate to really give a intelligent, researched testimony because of the constraint of time. Furthermore, because of the fact that we are so wrapped up in still the MMIS situation that has created such a burden, financial, time-wise, all-wise, with the providers, that in itself, I just wish it could get out of the way so that we could concentrate on some of these other things. We've got background check proposed regs that just came out. There's just so many things that are inundating providers right now that it is making it difficult if you don't have a department that is nothing but compliance, that are looking at regulations and studying these, to really become beneficial, I believe, even to the department or anyone listening to testimony, because it's very difficult. We will submit in writing, of course, something, but sometimes I don't believe that things that are in writing, and I could be wrong, maybe don't get the same audience as maybe you would when you had public testimony. So with that little pre-statement, I'm just going to kind of give a few highlights of things that just kind of bother the assisted living world. Number one, it has to do with page 3, that has to do with the a department being satisfied that a provider possesses certain skills. And if I look at the provider conditions of participation, and because these will be adopted by reference, I can only assume that that is something that's going to be where the department is going to be looking as far as some of these qualifications and these different things. And just for instance, the one that pertains to the residential supported living services, when you look at the highlighted part that they have in red on those particular proposals, you see that it has been defined down with a program administrator in regards to experience in education and human service fields or setting. And we just think that that narrowly defines too narrowly maybe what someone's qualification should or could be. This is a business. If people only have human services and they don't really understand the business that they're doing, I think it makes it difficult for providers as well as the department. So I look at this and I'm just a little bit concerned about this whole aspect that's in red here. The C part under program administration, under C1, even just C in itself, then talks about under residential supported living services, it says in addition to meeting education and experience requirements, the administrator must possess the knowledge base and skills necessary to carry out the respite care services program. A residential supported living doesn't have to have respite services in them. So I'm a little confused, I think, as far as what they're getting to here, especially when they go on talking about the medical and behavioral and rehabilitative. I know those services are out there, and I know that there are many of them that are within the residential supported living service community, but when you don't have those services, I'm just not really sure how that pertains specifically, or if you're under that, if you kind of get excluded on that because you're really not doing respite services. I'm just not sure how that's going to work under the conditions of participation. When we also go on page 3, they have added a part in here regarding 7AAC 132.20 that has to do with records. They now have put a part in that talks about the immediate custody of a provider's original records. There's no provision in here where that provider has the opportunity to copy those records, and I don't care if they have to have someone sitting there. I believe that a provider, before original records are removed from their premise, should have a right to copy at least whatever is being taken off under the eyes of someone watching, but I just believe that that has to be put in here somewhere. The other part here is at the bottom of page 3 on the actual regulations themselves. And if I get too long-winded, just tell me, I'll quit, because I see I'm up to 13 minutes or something here, so just let me know. 3 here also, 7AAC 130 under the 220J. This is a whole new section, repealed and readopted. It talks about fraud, abuse, or waste. I'm not sure how that definition of waste is going to be used out there. We obviously know fraud, abuse, they're pretty well defined. Waste, I think, is a pretty subjective terminology. Then I have a little bit of a real consideration and kind of a little trepidation about someone that comes in with credible allegations and shuts a program down for a provider just to find out that those credible allegations weren't so credible. And so in this section, wow, they find out that it's not so, it's not the case, so you go on, provider, enjoy, but you just had your business destroyed. I don't care if you've had it for 20 years. No provisions at all, no good faith stated by on the part of the department. If we go to page 5, we see that they have changed the 7AAC 132.24, and they have added in here a medical professional. And Teresa Brisky, I think, will get a lot more into this, maybe a little bit more articulate than I am. But I just have a little bit of confusion on what a medical professional is. If you have an RN within your assisted living home, whether they're on contract or otherwise, and something happens and so you consult them because they're the RN that you've hired for different services that have to be within your assisted living, does that count as a medical professional? And therefore now we have all of these things on this page, whether it has to do with restricted intervention, whether it has to do with a critical incident report, whether it has to do with the medication error, whatever else it is, does it rise to that occasion then because they have got an RN? And is that what the intent was with the department for that medical professional to include an RN that you might have on staff or on contract? So that's the one on that one. I'm going to let Teresa talk to the whole medication issue that comes on page 5 and on page 6, because she just really has a handle on that. And now I'm to page 7, and I totally apologize, but that is as far as I got, because that's all the time I had to go through these, and I appreciate the fact that we still have more time in order to at least submit our written comments. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And yes, let me remind folks that we will accept written comment until June 30th. Okay, thank you. Okay, let's go to Kenai. Deborah Hibbert, please give your comments. Deborah, if you're speaking, we cannot hear you. Okay, we will check with you again. Let's go on to Arturo Evangelista. Please give your comment. I hope we're not having some technical difficulties here. Let's try Juno, Doug Bridges. Would you like to give your comment? Well, our technical folks say we're okay. If folks are not able to call in, if folks are not able to be heard, I think you should call the Anchorage Legislative Information Office. Okay, let's go back to the room here in Anchorage. Lizette? Steer? Please give your comment. Thank you.
Well, I echo some. This is Lizette Steer, and I'm the new executive director for the Alaska Association on Developmental Disabilities. And we echo some of the comments just made in the sense of the short timelines in terms of ability to respond to this with the multiple other issues going on within the field. And so we have not had a chance to go closely through the comments, but do plan to submit written comments. But the one thing I did want to include in this is how much AADD has appreciated the fact that the state did incorporate people from the field in work groups in order to address these issues, and we do see some of the things addressed that we had asked for that are changes from the last one. So my comment is one of appreciation at this point. We will have, I'm sure, multiple other comments to make in writing in addition to that one. So when I've had a chance to look at them more deeply and talk to all of our folks, we will submit much more lengthy comment.
Thank you very much. And we do appreciate things in writing. Thank you. Teresa Brisky, please give your comment.
Good afternoon. I'm Teresa Brisky. I'm representing assisted living in a multiple of ways. I'm pretty sure that I mirror the sentiments of my colleague Sherry earlier, but just for the record, I just wanted to state that the past year, in particular the past 6 months of changes to the regulations, to the COPS, everything that seems to be going on, you know, the harmony, there's all these multiple things, there's several things going on. I could tick them off. I know you're very aware of what they are. Is creating an overwhelming burden to us to try to ensure that we are even following what's expected and trying to stay on top of it, including being able to be prepared for an event such as today, particularly when the notice for this comes out and it's less than 2 weeks that we have this particular public comment opportunity. So I probably will not be as articulate as I normally would try to be. Certainly we'll try to get something submitted in writing, but I just wanted it for the record that I want to thank the department and thank everyone involved for trying to work towards better programs for the people that we serve, for trying to improve the quality of the services, et cetera. I completely respect that. However, I feel that a great in-service is being done because I don't think that providers can possibly stay up with many of the things that are going on, stay informed. I'm college educated. I'm a pretty bright person. I pride myself in feeling that this stuff is truly integral to my role as an administrator of a large assisted living home. I have no idea how people are really not only staying up with these things, but actually able to understand them and even formulate opinions on them, and particularly implementing them once they've become in regulation or adopted by reference. So I just wanted to start out by saying that, because I hope that if you guys hear that from enough people that you may consider the idea of maybe suspending some things, putting it on the back burner, focusing like one thing at a time and making it right the first time instead of sort of this hurried, jumbled mess of a train that's running, you know, with all of these cars attached to it at the same time, that feels to me like it's just kind of get bungled up. So I just wanted to start out by saying that. I do have some comments about what I was able to go through. Like Sherry, I was not able to fine-tooth comb it like I normally would. However, I think I had some probably either questions or clarifications that I'd maybe like to see in a maybe if there's an opportunity for the state to come back with some, typically they'll do a FAQ or even a workshop or something, particularly pertaining to, as Sherry alluded to, the medication piece of it. There is a lot of confusion out there right now because we have already existing regulations and COPs that speak to medication administration versus self-administration or assistance of self-administration. My understanding was that as an assisted living provider, we were that one exempted group from having to do administration. We could, if we so choose, and thereby there are requirements followed with, you know, nursing and delegation. However, I am now seeing in the proposed COPS, et cetera, that now they're requiring training for the self, you know, the self-administration of medications. And I'm concerned because I think there's a lot of confusion now about who's expected to do what. And recently there was a fax that was sent out to a bunch of assisted living providers from a nurse who has a business about a medication administration training program that she says on this fax that this is now required by the state. Sorry, I've got so many things here, all these jumbles of paper here. I pull it out to read to you verbatim. But basically, the facts was a statement that this is a new training requirement by the state for all assisted living entities. It's a four-hour training. It's a $300 per home. I get it if she's trying to do some kind of a marketing thing to, you know, get some business for herself, but I'm very concerned. Is she misrepresenting information? She claims that she called the state and was told by licensing that this is a required course now that all assisted living homes have to be taught by an RN. And I said, and I'm thinking, and I've left a message with licensing, but in my mind I'm thinking, I think they're only speaking to entities who actually do medication administration. So if you're a home who does do that, then yes, you would maybe need to fulfill this requirement. But from what I'm seeing on paper right now, that is not a requirement. So there is even within our community and things being offered and you know, homes are jumping up and down going, oh my gosh, now I've got to spend all this money for this medication administration training program, et cetera, et cetera. So I just, if we could just slow down, pull back.
If I could, I can clarify that
okay.
Assisted living homes are exempt from the entire chapter.
That's kind of what I thought, but I have a copy of the facts that went out. So I have a message to licensing.
You're getting information not from us.
Okay. So again, because of all of this, I think there's mass confusion going on, and again, another reason why stepping back, slowing down, and maybe piecing this out as opposed to everything all at once. So, okay. So that is helpful to know. So I understand that there is now, however, going to be requirements if things go through for self-administration, that training. And I think that is a good idea. However, I do have – maybe you can clarify this for me. It removed the section that says must be approved by department.
Assisted living homes are exempt from the entire section.
Okay, but there's a section in there that's under the conditions of participation for all providers. It just says providers. It doesn't specify which ones. That speaks to the self-administration. If you assist with self-administration, it speaks to having to have this. It actually is in the conditions of participation now that we have to have training. And I'll try to find that page so I can show it to you. And it makes sense because that is typically what we would do in assisted living is we would assist, you know, self-assistance with administration. However, I guess what I just want to clarify is if that is going to go into effect for assisted living, that it is clarified whether or not an RN is required, because to me that particular aspect of it does not require RN oversight. So I think it would be good to have that clarified if assisted living does end up falling under the purview of that based on how it's currently written, or if that was not the intention that that's looked at. And that is stated so that people understand that that's not required and that does it or does it not have to be approved by the department, because the COPS will say must be submitted to SDS for approval or whatever, but then maybe the regulation piece just says, you know, it took that bracket out. So I think that's a little confusing, so maybe just something to go back and review. The other section I wanted to look at was on page 3 where it's 7AAC 130.220F3, where it is speaking about taking immediate release of records. I understand the right of the state to, I guess, seize records if they think it's necessary. And my understanding, based on what I read, was that there's a concern that, you know, documents may be manipulated. I would like there to be some protection for providers added, that the provider may make a copy of such records prior to the release to the state. And if you wanted to put stipulations in there that a state employee must oversee this or be witness, whatever. However, just as your concern that a provider may manipulate records, I think as a provider, I too share concerns that what will happen to those records and how will I defend myself later if you come back and say you were missing something or this happened and I don't even have a copy to look at. I also think it's necessary just in case there are still things I may need to refer back to with those documents for if it's pertaining to an existing or current resident that I have. So I would like to see a protection or some type of statement in regards to that added or considered in the rewrite. And then my other question did have to do, as Sherry mentioned, with the definition of what is a medical professional. I'm a registered nurse. Part of my policies for my home are that the staff call anytime there's an unusual situation with a resident so that we can help triage and oversee that. So technically they are getting consultation from a professional. However, they do not always rise to the level that the critical incident reporting requires. So by this statement, if you define an RN as a medical professional, and maybe you don't, however, if you do, then that would mean that the multiple reports I already send you would probably quadruple and would be very unnecessary, wasteful, you know, time. So just wanted to point that out. We already talked a bit about the medication stuff. That was definitely, I think that's definitely an area that needs to be clarified. There's, I think, a lot of misunderstanding going on, particularly if licensing themselves are supposedly giving this information to this person. Let's see. Oh, the other piece to that, where it talked about the medication administration and someone designating. If this is not going to apply to assisted living, then that's fine. I don't really have concerns. But if it is, the way that it's written, that a representative or the recipient may designate somebody, I feel it needs to be clarified, because does that mean they could grab a staff person or a staff member? Does it mean it's a family member? Can it just be, you know, their babysitter? You know, I think there just needs to be maybe a little bit more detailed clarification on who can that person be that they can designate to, and what is the responsibility of the provider, because here it makes it sound as though now the provider is responsible to coordinate that with that person. So then what liability, what responsibility now is put upon the provider if that particular person doesn't show up, doesn't cooperate, they fail to follow proper medication administration, et cetera, et cetera. So, again, I think that's another very fuzzy area that I would love to see more detail on before I would be comfortable being under that. As Sherry stated, I was able to really scrutinize up to that point. After that, it became a glimpse through. I don't see anything overt yet. Certainly, if I do, I will include it in my written testimony. So thank you very much for taking the time to see us today.
Thanks very much. Okay, let's try Juno again. Doug Bridges. Well, we're obviously having some technical difficulty here, so please stand by for those folks online. Mike Ocampo, please come and provide your comment.
Good afternoon. My name is Mike Ocampo. I represent the Assisted Living Home Providers Association of Alaska. We're called ALPA, and also administrator of Heart of Alaska and Sunset Haven here in Anchorage. Good afternoon, and thank you very much for giving me the chance and opportunity to speak out in behalf of this small assisted living home here in our state of Alaska. And let me start by reading a statement that I prepared that I would be sending out to you. It's regarding the comment on the proposed changes to regulations on condition of participation to Medicaid waiver service program. And this addressed to all of us stakeholders, that includes the state and us, the assisted living home providers, whether small or big, here in the state of Alaska. I, Chairman Michael Campo of Assisted Living Home Providers Association of Alaska, ALPA in short, and in behalf of all its officers and members, I am submitting our official position in response to the public comment to the proposed changes to regulations on condition of participation of home and community-based Medicaid waiver regulation changes. A continuing changes to Medicaid waiver regulation started in 2011, up to present with a primary objective of reorganization of the regulations that caused catastrophic economic displacement among small assisted living homes with five and under client residents in the state of Alaska. Small assisted living homes with five and under clients that I represent became a very successful program in 2010. Where from a mere below 100 homes skyrocketed into a 600-plus homes of assisted living home providers. Slowly thereafter, a series of aggressive resanctions resulting into closures of small assisted living homes engulfed the community. In 2011, a requirement of a very expensive audited financial report to be paid by us, the providers, were implemented in spite of legal opposition from small providers. In 2012 to 2013, a series of another major changes transitioned to issuance of prior authority on billing procedures up to the implementation of a new system from legacy to enterprise, were very complicated and very complex of mistakes, errors, billing denials, and non-payment resulted into cash advances to Medicaid providers that were mixed with complex problems. Xerox and Medicaid through SDS, Seniors and Disability Services, with DHSS Commissioner Struer and the officers of Xerox themselves admitted through the congressional hearing that were held, themselves admitted to the existing complex problems that were still currently ongoing. Letters of collection were sent out by Medicaid Accounting and Recovery Unit for advances to Medicaid providers to be paid in full by end of May 2014, and or payment plan to be affected on their billing thereafter. These supposed advances were services rendered by us already, the providers from the vulnerable adults under Medicaid waiver, which we do not owe, but requires reconciliation that requires a reasonable time period. We should not be given a deadline, rather, we should be helped in making the proper reconciliation, since Xerox have the primary source of capability to resolve such complex problems. Now, these proposed changes or additions to condition of participation to Medicaid waiver regulations that will have a very serious negative impact to us, again, the small assisted living home providers. Such changes, if implemented, will result into giving the Medicaid regulators licensing, and other related state agencies to act with impunity to sanctions, resulting into unabated closure of small assisted living homes with Medicaid waiver services certification to provide service. It will be the final nail in the coffin to all assisted living homes. Please refer to the proposed changes highlighted. I formally submit the Rhetoric Study, extensive comment period, and seeking the State of Alaska, the HHS, SDS, Medicaid waiver unit, to consider the negative impact to us, the small assisted living homes, once the said changes were prematurely implemented. We, the Association of Assisted Living Home Providers, were seriously contemplating of getting out of Medicaid waiver service program. Thank you very much. And let me just clarify and expound to what I just stated in my letter. Because, as Teresa just mentioned, I stumbled on this notice about 2 days ago only. I was away for over 3 weeks out of town. And then when I checked my emails, you know, I always check, and I thank you for sending them to me, that we have this comment on these proposed changes to the condition of participation, which, in effect, I agree with Teresa that up to now, I, you know, personally and officially would admit to you that I have not read thoroughly yet and immersed myself in understanding the complexities of this condition of participation in which my recertification is forthcoming, you know, in the next several months. But I've been getting a lot of feedback from all our members having difficulty of, you know, trying to meet all these requirements. In fact, one of the things that I would like to mention with regards to this condition of participation is that it looks like there's a repetitive things that is being required of us, like formulating policies that is already there in the regulation by itself. Meaning it's self-service already. It's self-understanding that what the regulation states and how come we are being required to submit a policy to that effect. And another thing is that with regards to medication management, you know, the reason why we are an assisted living, we only assist. We don't administer medication. We follow what the order of the physician, what is indicated on the label. And then at the same time, it is actually the recipient, which is the resident or client, who takes their own medication. We only assist them. So there's no need for us to be trained on the proper, you know, administration or assisting of giving out this medication. It's a service. It is just adding up to the complexity of making this operation of the assisted living home on providing the services for Medicaid a very difficult, you know, I would not say business, but this is an advocacy that we're doing, you know, helping our community, serving the vulnerable adults. And that's what we're doing the best we can. And that is why the small assisted living and per se, the assisted living home business and community in the state of Alaska became very popular and successful program in the state, in the United States of America. In fact, in 2010, we became number one in the service sector. And with that, I think it's, you know, it's very glaring that what these changes are, which we've been trying to be implemented now is an overkill, what I say. You know, I can say that it's an overkill, plus it's just giving more burden to us operators or providers, especially us as small assisted living home. I would like to acknowledge what you just mentioned that, you know, in this this medication requirement is not applicable to us small assisted living. But that's not what is happening in the field because licensing when they come in or some on the anti-fraud Medicaid unit go to the home, they start asking these kind of questions in which we still have to explain to them that we are only assisting. We are not administering. That is not our responsibility. Plus the fact that there's a label, there's an order from the doctor. It is more than enough. That is why what is saying here in this new proposed changes with regards to medical professional, you know, is correct. I agree with that. But there are certain conditions here that I would state again, I will repeat what Teresa just mentioned with regards to this, take immediate custody providers' original records maintained in accordance with 7AAC. When the department has reason to believe, this is a legal question. This is a legal matter. These are records of our resident, and this is a very, you know, we are running a business. And, you know, they cannot just take away all these records. There must be some legal procedure to this. At the same time, you know, we should be given a chance to respond to whatever question there is on the matter. If there is any, is that just a reason to believe? You know, if it's a reason, I can just say anything under the sun. You know, anybody can just claim something, that there's something wrong, and then they can just seize you. And to me, this is, again, a source of impunity in which we've been fighting for ever since. Until now, we have a legal question about that with regards to this aggressive behavior of some state agencies, you know, and stuff. And I'm not saying that all of them, they're very, very good, excellent, you know, government agencies, you know, and I acknowledge all of them. But let us, you know, let us not make our life difficult. We are just very small assisted living home, which I represent. And this is what we object, you know, because we saw it already, you know, forced closure, suspension of licenses, you know, of assisted living home. This is our bread and butter. We invested our life savings, our life, our time, you know, and all of us are dependent on this, and we create employment to our community. And that is why we are asking for more, at least give us more time. Let us talk on this, you know, properly and understand each other. And this is all we are asking for, you know. And before this can be, you know, we don't want this to be an instrument of an abuse again. You know, I acknowledge, you know, our you know, the departments, you know, especially the head of the departments. We're having a good rapport already. But then this another new changes will just waste all those because you don't know if they are not properly trained, and they just come to our home and then aggressively ask too much question, and they believe that there's an abuse or whatever, they right away they close you down without giving you enough time, you know, or proper reason, you know, to respond to whatever issue that may be resolved easily. And you know, also for a fact, I would like to make a statement that in the last 8 years that we are in the business of a small assisted living home, countless of recipients will benefit from this assisted living home. And we never had any citations from or any wrongdoings. And that is why these new conditions of participation that is now being implemented, as well as these proposed changes, we submit that there should be enough time for proper orientation and again, you know, maybe training or conference among state agency and us providers. And with this, I thank you very much for giving me the time as representing the Assisted Living Home Providers Association of Alaska. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mike. Try this again. Doug Bridges, please give your comment.
Hi, you copy me now okay, Angela?
Loud and clear. Thank you.
All right. Looks like it might have been muted on your end, but I'm glad we got it all fixed. I have a couple of comments about the transportation regulation changes. In the page 23 going to 24 is the section I'm looking at. And it points out that what is the new expectation would be to have a mileage for each trip segment for Medicaid waiver transportation service passengers. And I would like to state that I think that's going to be very difficult for providers to provide, because many times we're not dealing with just individual trips for individual passengers. We've got buses that contain 1 to 8 passengers on board with multiple drop-offs and locations. People who aren't Medicaid waiver service recipients. And to break out the trip segment for a person based on odometer readings, I will argue, won't be very effective or accurate. And so I would hope that that element would be considered to be removed from the regulations. I also am curious about the medical number one on page 24, where it says medical transportation services. The department will not pay under this section. It mentions medical transportation services authorized under 7 AAC number. So the question still remains that if there are no medical transportation service providers available in the community, I wonder if that is still an applicable regulation. And I'm also curious about the description that services will not be paid for destinations that are over 20 miles from the recipient's residence. I will look at the past regs. I'm not familiar with that, so I'm thinking that must be a new regulation. And I wonder about the reasoning for that. I know that there are waiver rates for trips that are over 20 miles that there is a special rate for that needs to be approved by the office there. But if that isn't the case, that a person has an approved care for plan for over 20 miles, I still wonder why that means that somebody can't be billed at the lower rate. I think that has a difficult effect on rural Alaska, where oftentimes trips are being provided over 20 miles. And so I would like to argue that not be included in the regulations. And question, and by the way, we are planning to submit written responses as well. And I reading through the regulations, I'm thinking that the new regulations apply to all Medicaid waiver trips, whereas before the previous regulation changes that went into effect this year curtailed any interim trips other than starting or ending at the residence. So I'm real pleased to see that there's a movement to open those trips back up. So that's a great change there. I just wanted to make sure that these new regs were applying to all of the trips. I don't know whether that is something that I can get any response from you or not. That's it for my comments at this point in time. I do have somebody else here at the table. Would we be able to include any comments from her right now? She's on the list.
Absolutely. Thank you, Doug. Tara, is that you? Tara Smith?
No, Julie Dyer.
Oh, sorry. Go right ahead, Julie.
Well, and I'll keep this brief. I just really want to reiterate the comments that other providers have made regarding the first several pages with the language that's being included as far as the possession of records without giving providers opportunities to make copies, as well as the language about fraud, waste, and abuse, since that is fairly vague. And then again with those items in regards to consultation with a medical professional. And then the one thing that I did want to say that I'm really encouraged to see is in the environment changes for repairs that you're including language that allows a contractor to be paid up front basically for supplies and materials. Many contractors have been disincentivized from even offering to do home modifications, home environment modifications, because they would be required to outlay most of the money up front. And I think that this will become a positive change, at least in Southeast Alaska, as far as contractors being willing to undertake those things with the new regs. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Angela. Tara Smith, are you on? Would you like to give your comment? For those of you who are not, who are speaking, but we cannot hear you, I've been advised to tell you to hang up and call back again. That's our first troubleshooting step. So if you have, if I've called on you, you've tried to speak and cannot, please hang up and just call back. Thanks so much. Arturo Evangelista, can you hear me?
Hello?
There you are. We hear you loud and clear. Go ahead and give your comment.
Hi. I just have comments about the provider conditions of participation. And most of it was already echoed by Michael Campo and Teresa Brisky. But just to add up to it, also the financial accountability of the conditions of participation, like the required general liability insurance, the automotive liability insurance, aside from the workman's compensation already that we are burdened with. These are way too much for a small assisted living home with small resources like us to be complying with. And given the fact that with the payment also that it's not even fixed, you know, we're either getting paid or not paid or underpaid, how can you comply with these conditions of participation for a small assisted living homes like us with small resources? If you plan on doing this, you should also think about also raising the pay. Does it, you know, it's just common sense. These things cost money. General liability insurance, automotive liability insurance, workman's compensation. On top of that, you know, your payroll taxes that you pay for your employees. These cost money for small business like us. And then with these conditions of participation coming down on us with all these new regs, how can we comply? How do you expect us, five and under homes, to comply when we're not even getting paid right? That's all. That's all I would like to say. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Okay, Deborah Hibbert.
Hi, this is her husband, Brent.
Hi, we hear you loud and clear. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thanks for letting us comment on this. We own the taxi company in Soldotna and Kenai, and with your new things here. The mileage is going to would be somewhat of a hardship to try to keep track of all the time with our in our business. And the other thing I would like to comment on is the stops. Because we are so rural here, a lot of the recipients live out of town from medical and grocery stores and socialization and that without the stop when they come in to go to a doctor's appointment and they get out of that, and most of the time they need to make a pharmacy stop or a grocery stop. And with not able to do stops, we're not being real efficient here. We're having to take them all the way back home and then bring them back to town and so they can pick up their prescriptions or any of their medical needs or groceries, as far as that goes. So we would really like to have a stop, be able to be put in that so we can be more efficient. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, anyone in the room here in Anchorage who would like to provide comment? Okay, on the line again, Rachel Greenberg.
Hi, thank you. I just a couple comments, I guess. First of all, I want to commend the division for working with the provider groups to try to come up with some regulations that we can live with instead of the ones that were there. And I guess one of the ones that I do want to make a comment is the adult day services. I really appreciate being able to expand our ability to bill for up to 10 hours a day instead of limiting it to 6. And then also, and maybe this is something that I've talked about in the past, which is facility-based habilitation. Meals and transportation are not an allowable separate payment. And it really needs to be separated so that the client could actually have choice, or if the provider itself of the day habilitation service might not be able to provide transportation, and so they could utilize whatever transportation service might be in the community that would be authorized, instead of having a one lump sum given to the day hab provider that then has to reimburse for transportation or meals if they're provided by another provider. It really needs to be changed to at least allow the facility-based day habilitation to not be have transportation and meals included in that one lump amount. The other comment really has been brought up before, which has to do with transportation, and I think Doug kind of mentioned this already, is the many times when we have we're transporting people, we have more than one person in the van, and so to be able to isolate the mileage between one person, picking up one person in their actual destination, may not be very accurate. I mean, if you want us to put mileage on there, that's fine, but it really truly is not going to be accurate if you have 5 or 6 people in the van. You're picking and people dropping people off along the way, and so that mileage is really not going to be accurate. And again, under the regulation, it says the department will not pay for transportation under the 7AAC 130.260 or 265, which has to do with the dehabilitation piece as well. And the incidental stop, really, it needs to be defined a little clearer, because I was talking to our transportation folks, and when you're talking about what's a reasonable, billable incidental stop versus what is just a stop that you're actually stopping because the client really needs to stop there, whether it be to the bank or to the library or to whatever that may be, it really needs to be clearer defined in the regulation because it's not clearly defined right now. But again, I do want to commend the division for working with providers because this is much better than what was released in July. So thank you.
Thanks, Rachel. Tara Smith, would you like to give your comment? Tara, if you're speaking, we cannot hear you. We've been advised that you should hang up and call back. So please try that. Thank you. That is everyone who wishes to make a comment right now. I have 5 minutes after 2. We will be here until 4:30, so we will stand by. Thank you. Okay, we are back, regulation hearing, and ready to hear from Joanne Wise. Please give your comment.
What's that, Joanne Wise, that you asked for?
Yes. Is that you, Joanne?
That's me, yeah.
Okay, terrific. Give your comment, please.
Well, I haven't been listening to the other comments. I just got in. So looking at the section regarding the submission of plan of care. I believe that under the 7AAC130.217 and number 5, it seems very unclear of what we're really saying here. We're saying it's based on a current assessment or a reassessment and the approval level of care determination. I feel like those wording is very unclear of exactly what we're talking about, because in a current assessment, that would be something that the state of Alaska would be doing. And with the new procedure that the state has implemented doing set plans of care date, we are not having current assessments or level of care. So I'm not sure how the care coordinator would be able to know what the regulations clearly state and where the state stands on having us having current assessments so we can develop these plans of care. That's the end of my comment.
Thank you, Joanne.
You're welcome.
Again, we will stand by. Thank you. this will close the regulation hearing for 130, 70AC 130. Thank you very much. Public comment is open until June 30th. Please send your written comments. Thank you.